This is Vis-a-Vis, a podcast series brought to you by the Alliance Program at Columbia University. Vis-a-Vis features conversations that challenge our understanding of key global, economic, and social issues by casting them in a transatlantic perspective. I'm Emmanuel Catan. I head the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University and three French universities, Sciences Po, Paris 1 Panthéon-Sorbonne, and École Polytechnique. Every episode, I sit down face-to-face with, or as we say in French, vis-a-vis, some of the most insightful thinkers on both sides of the Atlantic. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Over the last decades, the world of cinema has gone through profound transformations. The advent of streaming platforms, the COVID pandemic, and the introduction of AI technology at multiple stages of film production all contributed to create a new landscape which raises many questions about cinema in the future. Will cinema theaters thrive again? Or have we entered a world where streaming will dominate? What are the major trends shaping the world of cinema today? How do social movements from Black Lives Matter to Me Too influence film content? Do film festivals still play an important role in influencing what we watch and shining a light on lesser-known filmmakers? How does the proliferation of film production impact the way we watch movies and how they affect us? To cast light on these questions, we're very honored to welcome today one of the leading cinema experts, Richard Pena. Richard Pena is a renowned professor of cinema and film critic. For over 35 years, he taught cinema at Columbia University, where he founded the MA program in film studies. He's now emeritus professor at Columbia, and he's also taught film history and theory at Princeton, Harvard, Paris 1 Panthéon-Sorbonne, the University of São Paulo, Beijing University, and Jadavpur University, to name just a few. Richard Pena has served as the program director of the Film Society at the Lincoln Center and was the director of the New York Film Festival from 1988 to 2012. Until recently, he was the host of Reel 13 Classics on PBS Channel 13. Richard Pena, welcome to Vis-a-Vis.
Thank you, Emmanuel. Good to be here.
I'd like to start, perhaps, by asking you how you discovered cinema, how you started this love story with film. I'm reminded that the French filmmaker François Truffaut once described how he would skip school in the afternoon in order to go to movie theaters. Is that what you did already? Also, did you also skip school to go to the movies?
I can't say I ever skipped school to go to the movies, but by the time I was in college, I was certainly organizing my course schedule according to what was playing in and around Boston and Cambridge. At that time, there were a number of really excellent repertory cinemas, and many of them started in the afternoon. So if one of them was doing a retrospective on Tuesday afternoons that I wanted to see, I had to make sure there were no classes I needed or wanted to take at that particular time. So, yeah, by college years. But when I was younger, I didn't really have the opportunity for that.
Right, exactly, thankfully. And so do you remember when you saw your first movie in a theater, and what were your impressions, both the kind of impressions you had of being in a dark room with other people and also your impressions of that film, if it did actually stick in your memory?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't the first film that I saw, I'm sure, but the first one that really made an impression on me that I can still very much remember was a film called Jason and the Argonauts. It was one of the films that featured animation by the great Roy Harryhausen, who did these wonderful kind of stop-motion animations with, you know, dolls of Cyclopses and things like that. So, you know, it was a sort of a spectacular for its day. And the scene I remember especially was when Jason and his men were fighting an army of skeletons. And it was really kind of remarkable, very well done. But at the same time, I remember this kind of weird sadness that how could you kill a skeleton? You know, you couldn't really stab it. But you saw the scene anyway. And anyway, I remember really liking that movie a lot. And just at that point, becoming one of those people who saw more movies than almost anybody else that I knew.
Right. And how did you, at the time, as as a child, and then later as a teenager, how did you discover new movies? I mean, obviously, you know, there were movies shown in movie theaters, etc. But it wasn't like today, when you know, you could just basically watch movies on streaming platforms. What were the pathways to, you know, watch old movies?
Well, there were a lot of old movies shown on television. You know, at first, Hollywood boycotted television. By 1953, Columbia signed a deal with WOR, one of the stations in New York, to have 50 films sold to them. And they used to have a show called Million Dollar Movie, which would, I think, show movies like in the morning, the afternoon, and the evening, often the same film three times. So there are a lot of films that I saw quite a few times during those years. But really, for me, the epiphany was when I was, I think, about 10, and I went to the library, and I already was quite struck by painting. I had gone quite often to museums like the Metropolitan and also MoMA, seen, the Impressionists. And I remember I was looking for a book, I guess maybe it was on the Impressionists or something like that. And in the old Dewey Decimal System, I think art was 790. But there was actually a little section that if you went to 793 was on cinema. I can remember really being just struck and fascinated by the fact that there were books about movies, and movies were just something that existed. You know, I could imagine you could write about them in that way. It hadn't really crossed my mind yet. So anyway, I looked at the section, probably didn't have more than 10 books or so in it, but one of them was a book called The Liveliest Art, which was kind of a little history of cinema. So I checked it out and read it immediately, cover to cover. And that was the first time I sort of started to put together some larger picture of the movies, you know, some sense of history, some sense of development differences. I became aware of certain names that perhaps I had heard or I hadn't heard of, and that helped to sort of start guiding my viewing, because by then, again, New York had the Museum of Modern Art's film program and a lot of repertory cinemas and even smaller kind of organizations. So, you know, I began sort of keeping lists. You know, I really wanted to make sure I saw every film by Buster Keaton or every film that was by Howard Hawks or, you know, all these people I read about. And then, you know, the even greater epiphany came when I was, I guess, about 12, and the New York Film Festival had already begun. And this was the third edition of the festival, and they were showing a film by Eric von Stroheim called The Wedding March. And I'd never seen a von Stroheim film, but I knew from The Liveliest Art and other books that I began to read that his films were not only important, but difficult to see. So I thought this was a great opportunity to see this. And so I asked my parents, and they were very kind. They said, well, yes, you can go, but I have an aunt who's still with us. She just turned 100, who took me to the New York Film Festival to see The Wedding March. And I can remember going into the Metropolitan Opera, which is where the festival was held in those early years, and just couldn't believe that I was in a room with 2,000 other people who also knew who Eric von Stroheim was. It just seemed like suddenly my secret passion was, you know, part of a much larger movement. And a man came out. His name was Henri Langlois, and he was introduced as the director of the Cinémathèque Française. I had no idea what that was, but he was said to be the man who had found this film, or at least was presenting it. And he spoke a little bit about it, and after he left the stage, the lights went down. A man named Arthur Kleiner began playing piano and accompaniment, and that was that. I was hooked. I thought, this is the rest of my life. This is where I want to be.
What a beautiful story. And what you're saying as well is that enjoying movies for you is not just about being there and watching the movie, but it is also very much about talking about movies and discussing this. Did you at this early age, did you have a kind of film buddy with whom you would discuss your impressions or debate or disagree with what you'd seen?
When I was very young, there were a couple of other people who, you know, liked to go to the movies, not as much as I did, but they did like going. That changed when I got to high school. In high school, I discovered a number of kindred spirits who seemingly were as obsessed with movies as I was. And there was a great teacher. He was a drama teacher at our high school. I went to a Catholic boarding school in New England in Massachusetts. And he actually had something that he had founded called the Foreign Film Club. And the Foreign Film Club would just about every Sunday night show, on 16 millimeter, a foreign film, most of them from the Janus catalog. So that was the first time I got to see a number of foreign classics. And then I think it was sometime during the second year, because he lived not that close to the school, he told myself and my best friend, why don't you two run this? And from that point on, my friend Lloyd and I were the ones who selected films for the foreign film club. So we could see things that we wanted to see or things that we want to see again or all those kind of things.
And this is when your sense that talking about movies, that analyzing how a movie is made, its message, its content, the way in which characters interact with each other, that's when it developed? Or did your desire also to communicate your love for movies come a little bit later?
Kind of complex to answer that. In a way, one could say that I think what attracted me first was, and still attracts me, was the communal experience. I mean, I liked the idea of obviously showing films in public. That was the only way you could see movies back then. But the way it brought a community together. And of course, naturally, when that community comes together, a very natural result of that is conversation, is discussion. So we would often have, after these screenings, discussions. By then, of course, again, we weren't that far from Boston, so on weekends we could go in, and if there was a new movie we all wanted to see, my friends and I would go. Sometimes they're American movies. I remember all of us trying to get into Bonnie and Clyde, which had to be, I don't know how old for, but some of us weren't up to the age level. We very figured out a way to get in. And then other films, and obviously new Bergman films, Fellini films, Buñuel films. We really loved Buñuel, all of us. So we were always very excited when there was a new Buñuel film in town. And for me, I mean, this was kind of an obsession. It was part of my life. I never imagined where it would lead. I mean, it just seemed like this was something I did. And okay, yes, I did a little bit more than most people, but still it was kind of seen almost like a hobby.
And then in 1988, one of your dreams came true and you became the director of the New York Film Festival. And so during that time, you had obviously huge influence in, you know, discovering new filmmakers and new movies and bringing them to the public in New York and indeed also influencing the world as well. What has changed since then? And I'd like perhaps to understand a little bit better, first of all, what is the role of a film festival director? What influence does he or she wield? But also, how has that evolved in time? And is that changing now that algorithms seem to be deciding what we're watching?
Well, the role of film festival director has changed over time, as festivals have changed over time. And, you know, the festival exists in a number of different variations. Just very quickly, the very first festivals, like Venice and Cannes and Berlin and whatever, were very official festivals, meaning that the director of the Berlin Film Festival or someone there would write to Film Polsky or to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences and say, please send us a film for our festival. And they would send a film, and then whether or not the film was selected, that'd be something else. But the sort of selection process had a certain official pallor to it. The second phase of festivals, of which I think the New York Film Festival, founded in 1963, is a prime example, along with Pesaro and Rotterdam and a few others, were what you might call curated festivals. And this is where you had a director, usually a very strong personality, like Lino Michiké in Pesaro or Richard Rowd in New York or Hubert Bals in Rotterdam, whose festivals were reflections of them, of their taste, of what they thought was interesting and whatever. And that often meant, you know, turning down, you know, films by even famous filmmakers and, of course, applauding or promoting work by others. And New York was, as I said, a quintessential example of that. The first 5 years was Richard Rowd and Amos Vogel, another extraordinary critic and man who had a big influence on me in many ways. And the two of them would make the selections. Amos left after the 1967, the fifth edition of the festival. And then Richard stayed until 1987, at which point I took over. You know, those festivals, while there was a committee of selection, I think one can say somewhat safely that they reflected very much a kind of Richard Rowd vision of what cinema was every year, where it was at, where it was going, who were the important figures to look at. And Richard was correct far more often than he was incorrect. You know, it was thanks to Richard that, you know, so many figures from Bertolucci to Straub to, the new German cinema. I mean, all kinds of, you know, really great films came into the United States because the New York Film Festival was, and I think still is, really the gatekeeper for international and independent cinema in the United States. Independent cinema and the American variety now, of course, probably depends more on Sundance or South by Southwest. But, you know, I think back then it was really the New York Film Festival that was the arbiter of a lot of that work. And, you know, the festival made a very wise decision, one that I followed, which was to remain small, to, you know, only show 25 to 28 films in a given year. So it was a very manageable number of films, and the coherence of it made for a kind of portrait. You know, here's what we think. It wasn't representative. There were, you know, years that sections of the world were left out, but it was very much a reflection of the director and the people he worked with, you know, which has its upsides and downsides. But for me, it was something that always felt personal and always felt adjudicated. After that phase of curated festivals, which of course continued, you have what you could call the mega festivals. And that was when you began to get festivals like Toronto, Montreal, Seattle, Chicago, which showed literally hundreds of films. And in a way, they were I don't think consciously, but set up almost against the curated festivals in that they wanted to give the audience a broad panorama of films, you know, many, many films. And, you know, as a good friend who worked for the Toronto Film Festival would always say to me, I'd rather let the audience make the choice. That's one way of looking at it. That's not the way I looked at it. I thought that we should help make the choice and really make a statement as to what we wanted to show and not show. That did not please everybody, I can tell you that. But that was the tradition that I think Richard Rowd and Amos Vogel left me, and it was one I was very happy to adopt.
Right. And do you think that festivals still are playing this role today? Again, you know, there are many different decision-making channels, I guess, in selecting films and in pushing certain films to the top. Do film festival directors today wield the same power? And do the festivals count in the same way as they did?
Frankly, and I'm not saying this just because I no longer work for a festival, I don't think as much. And that's just because, you know, back in my day, or a little before my day, maybe at the festival, when in New York City you spoke about, oh, that was in the festival, everybody knew you meant the New York Film Festival. Now there are literally dozens of festivals in New York, and every weekend you get to go to a festival. So it's lost that sheen, one could say. I still think the New York Film Festival is a certain kind of respect and legitimacy that perhaps many of the others don't, but still, you know, I think the brand has been watered down, one could say. The other thing is now that you have such a kind of extraordinary possibility for seeing so many films, legitimately or illegitimately. I know every year after Cannes, there's a little bit of a scramble when some of these films get put on different sites and suddenly you can see films that were just at Cannes last week. And, you know, obviously this does make the producers very happy and whatever. So that sense of you have to wait until the fall to see a new film, you know, in the New York Film Festival, again, that's gotten watered down as well. The New York Film Festival, another thing it did from its very first edition was always include maybe a sidebar of older films, you know. And that, I think, was really another way of just introducing, you know, the new films within a kind of vision of film culture. And that's something the festivals continue to do over its 63-year history, and something I've always supported and, you know, I like very much doing. But again, you don't really need the festival for that so much anymore. There's so much that's available on DVD or through streaming or things like that, that it's, again, lost a little bit of what made it unique.
Right. There's also concern, I guess, about the cinema theaters themselves. So the way in which we experience cinema and whether these will remain and continue to thrive. Obviously, we've been through COVID. I understand that the levels of, you know, cinema going, at least in cinema theaters, have not actually gone back to the levels they were at. They've increased over the last couple of years, but they're not back at pre-COVID level. There are also, you know, evolutions, as, you know, you've just said, regarding film festivals. But you were describing, I remember, you know, back in 2015, a very lively cinema scene, particularly in New York City. You were talking about micro cinemas cropping up in restaurants and bars and art galleries, and you called this phenomenon the exhibition culture of resistance. Are there still the seeds of this exhibition culture of resistance today? And will this kind of golden age of cinema that you were describing pre-COVID, will it come back?
It's always hard to say. I mean, things are somewhat cyclic. I think the general trend is away from theatrical exhibition. I'd like to not say that's true, but it seems to me pretty much obvious in larger and larger parts of the world that, you know, people are not going to movie theaters, as you said, in the same numbers, even for big Hollywood films. And I think even less for foreign films, unfortunately. My own film students at Columbia, I can remember asking them how often they went to see a movie in a movie theater, and the answer was once or twice a month. I was seeing movies four or five times a week when I was their age. Now, that doesn't mean they're not watching movies. They're watching lots of movies, but they're not watching them theatrically. And I think that's something we can ask what that means and how that changes film culture in a certain way. But, you know, just yesterday, as it happened, I was talking to someone who works in actually the New York City Office of Culture, and I was telling me about some of the expansion projects for some of these little micro cinemas that started back in that pre-COVID era and managed to make it through. And now they're trying to build a second screen or trying to put in fixed chairs as opposed to folding chairs or, you know, all trying to improve. So obviously there is an energy and an interest in continuing that. Yeah, I do think it's a little bit of a losing battle. But again, in New York City, you'll always have an audience for that. You know, I think people live in New York partially because they really love culture. And there's a lot of culture here. I sometimes use the example of opera. And if you go back to 1900, there were, 70 opera companies in New York. And now there's basically one, you know. Now, it doesn't mean the Metropolitan Opera is going to disappear. There'll always be people going and there'll be opera fans. But it has really changed. It's become kind of an elite art, a kind of a museum art in a certain way. And something not the same, but I think something parallel will happen to cinema.
And do you personally experience a film differently? I mean, clearly we all do between streaming and going to a film theater. What is the qualitative difference in this experience? Do you feel, for example, that you remember a movie better if you've seen it in a dark room with other people?
I'm not sure I necessarily remember it better, but there is just that feeling of, again, being part of a temporary community. That suddenly this community has come together to watch this film. And even though you don't know these people and you probably won't speak to any of them, you still feel you're part of something, you know. And that's, you know, an experience that I cherish. It's something I grew up with. And again, there was that feeling like I had at that first New York Film Festival screening of suddenly being in a club of which I didn't realize I was a member.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's one of the things that comes with theatrical viewing. You know, again, there used to be more of a, I want to say consensus, but there would be a film that everybody saw, you know, around the same time. You would talk about it and argue it and debate. You don't have that anymore. I can even find, like, I'll talk to friends and say, what are you streaming? And they're always streaming things that I never heard of. And I'll tell them what I'm streaming. I say, oh, yeah, I haven't heard about that. So, I mean, you know, the scenes become so dispersed, or maybe we've become so atomized that it's hard to think of kind of a mass culture in that way.
It's also, I guess, that production, the sheer size of cinema production has increased so much.
Yeah.
I understand that, you know, it's increased fivefold since the 1950s
at least,
and maybe even more. What's the impact of this? Not just in terms of the fact that, you know, there it's much more difficult for lesser-known filmmakers to come up to the to the surface because the competition is very harsh, but also in terms of cinema viewers themselves and, you know, cinema lovers. Does it affect the appreciation of a movie, the fact that you know that this, you know, that there are hundreds of other movies that you're not seeing? For example, you know, today, you know, in the 1950s, for example, you know, when you had, I don't know, about 5,000 movies coming out every year, you know, someone like you could probably say, well, I've seen most of the movies I wanted to see this year. Today, it's much more difficult to be able to say that. And does that diminish the pleasure that you have?
I do think that that first position, saying I've seen most of the movies I want, was often based on ignorance, and I don't mean that in a mean way. I mean, I think it's people saying I've seen all the French or German, or but, you know, have they actually seen the Chinese or Japanese or Latin American films that also were out that year? So, you know, the notion of what constitutes world cinema has really expanded. You know, world cinema for most of the New York Film Festival really meant the cinema of five nations or six nations. You know, by the time I got there, the definition had expanded a lot. We became much more aware of film in many different parts of the world. And some of this was the effort of curators and programmers who did really terrific work. And some of it was just an availability that came with, at first, VHS and then DVDs and eventually links. You know, you could suddenly see 30 Iranian films, you know, without having to ship 35 millimeter prints from Tehran to New York. Mm-hmm. So that really, you know, when people say, oh, you know, you opened up the New York Film Festival. Well, perhaps I did, and I'm proud of that, but I had a much greater chance to than my predecessors did. You know, it would have been much harder for them to be aware of these myriad film movements than it was for me.
Right. You've done so much to, you know, increase knowledge about national cinemas from around the world. I'm thinking in particular about Latin American cinema, but also Chinese. And you just mentioned Iranian cinema, which you were probably one of the pioneers in bringing Iranian cinema to the United States. I'm thinking about the connection between the influence of those films and the way in which a country, for example, like Iran might be perceived, you know, by the general public and in the media. Do you have hope or indeed do you have examples of how the greater exposure to, you know, Iranian films might have impacted how we, the general public, think about a country like Iran, which seems to be mediated mostly by, you know, what we read online?
Well, first you have to say that when you talk about general public means far beyond the community of Columbia people. So, I mean, you know, as much as I like and admire Iranian cinema, it certainly is not known at all by the broad U.S. public. I think when a Separation won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film, for many people, I think they're absolutely shocked that Iran made films, you know, let alone one good enough to win the Best Foreign Film Oscar. I'll give you a little anecdote, which is something I like very much. Years ago, when the U.S. was in one of its, you know, how could you say, repeated confrontations with Iran about something, and there were some people calling that we have to bomb Tehran or we have to do something like that. One of my students, who I know was also an aficionado of Iranian cinema, was saying, oh, what do you think is going to happen? And I said, well, I think probably nothing as always. I think it's a lot of saber rattling or things like that. And he said, yeah, I got so upset, though, when people were talking about bombing Tehran. I thought, like, what happens if they bombed Kiarostami? And I was so touched by that. I mean, you know, that this young American felt, you know, such a connection to the work of this Iranian filmmaker. He was really worried that he might get hurt in a kind of conflict between the U.S. and Iran. And maybe that's what movies do. They make you suddenly care about somebody who you've never met, you might have seen on screen or on stage or something like that. But now this person is a kind of factor in your life, and you worry about his or her, in this case, his well-being.
Mm-hmm. And what about the way in which certain social movements that have emerged in recent years, what about their influence on filmmakers themselves and the way in which they produce content and more broadly, you know, I'm thinking of, obviously, of you know, the Me Too movement and Black Lives Matter. How do we see these social movements reflected today? Are they reflected more often in films today? It certainly seems so from anecdotal evidence. And is there an impact also on the diversity of the film industry themselves? So, for example, do you see an increase in women filmmakers over the last decades?
There's no doubt there's been an enormous increase, I think, in women filmmakers, often perhaps not in the productions with the biggest budgets or things like that, but certainly any given year at, say, South by Southwest or Sundance, you know, those see a very large number, and many foreign countries. I think over a third of all new films in France every year are by women filmmakers. And I think there have also been some strides by filmmakers who are from either Arab or sub-Saharan African origin or whatever in, say, the French cinema. It's a very broad question. I mean, I think that what it's done, those movements broadly have just made us really consider what we show as programmers and perhaps what we make as filmmakers. Take, for example, the question of violence against women. You know, a couple of times it was pointed out to me, gee, a lot of your films in your class have, you know, scenes of women being beaten or raped or attempted. And when I thought about it, I thought, yeah, it's really true. I mean, what does that mean? What does that say? I mean, does it mean it's just for me a kind of almost fictional conceit that these things happen? And what do we do about it? I think it's, again, I'd hate to see something not be shown, but I think you have to confront the fact that you're showing a film to people, hopefully at least half your class, who might have a very bad reaction to this film in which a woman gets killed or something like that. So I'm glad it's made us more aware. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't show it, but maybe we should think a little bit about it before we show it.
Mm-hmm. And looking to the future, it's interesting to see that a lot of speculation, of course, has to do with technology. You know, we've talked about streaming, also AI technology, of course, that a lot of people are talking about. But what's interesting is that this was a concern, you know, even years ago, the way in which technology impacts cinema. And there's an essay you like to quote from a Cuban filmmaker, Julio García Espinoza, who predicts, I think, in the 1970s or 80s, that far from disappearing, filmmaking will expand significantly in the future, and that thanks to advances in technology, again, that's him arguing that everyone will be able to have a shot at making films. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems that his prophecy today has come true to some extent. You know, with an iPhone camera and software technology, you can probably do, with a little bit of help, you can probably do a film yourself. Has that had an impact on cinema? And what is the impact that you perceive? Is it leading to greater uniformization of cinema, kind of TikTokization of movies? Or do you think that, on the contrary, it's allowed for new talents to emerge?
Mm-hmm. Again, complex question. The essay that you're referring to, For an Imperfect Cinema by Julio García Espinoza, ends actually with a line about how cinema won't disappear into nothing, it'll disappear into everything. And I think that that's, you know, one way of looking at it. I mean, I think García Espinoza was very prescient in imagining that in just a little while, we'd all be able to become filmmakers, because it was no longer the idea that you must go to a film school or you must do this or something. You know, and quite frankly, you know, sometimes when I'm lecturing to an audience, I will say, any one of you could be a filmmaker. You could make a film on your phone, you know, and people have. We have the phenomenon of Sean Baker, who, you know, started out as a cell phone filmmaker and now won Cannes, not with a cell phone film, but still, I think, with elements of that aesthetic that have persisted in his work. Do you know, I think that is a certain phrase we used to use a lot in the 60s, which was to demystify cinema. That is, to take it out of the hands of magic. There's a great kind of French Milton film, Classe de Lutte, made in 1969 around the strikes. And, you know, and there's a sign on a wall which says, cinema is not magic, it's a technology. And I think that's an important thing to do, to really say that, in fact, we can all make films. We can all make films about different things. The number of voices should be unlimited. And that's been, you know, for me, one of the very hopeful signs over the last 20 years. Not only in the American cinema do we have an incredible proliferation of new voices in the cinema, but at the same time, you know, we have access to films from so many more countries, so many more cultures. So that's the good side of globalization, one could say, that really has happened. Now, on the other hand, I think we have a kind of renewed corporate presence that, you know, if you look at the history of, say, that industry, one could say from, you know, 1920 till about 1950 or 60, you know, you had a very solid structure we might call the Hollywood studio system. But from 60 up until the 90s, you know, suddenly it was a free-for-all. Suddenly, and I think it's a very interesting moment for cinema in many places. I mean, you had structures, corporate structures, but they were significantly weaker and less influential than I think you had in other moments. But beginning, one might say earlier, but certainly by 1990, you had a re-corporatization of cinema in a way. And it headed towards streaming and, you know, video or platforms in a way. You know, in 1993, you had the famous or infamous GATT talks, where the U.S. kind of took on the rest of the world in terms of budget subsidies for cinema and state support for national film industries. And the U.S. lost that battle, but a concession they were able to get was to make countries like European countries and other open their markets to audiovisual and TV production. You know, the U.S. was very smart. Within 7 years or 5 years, everybody would be showing The Sopranos. Everybody would be showing The Wire. Suddenly, there was a whole new market for U.S.-based work. And, of course, that expanded into other kinds of work as well. But, you know, the television platform became the new standard for media communication. Now, that didn't mean that cinema melted away or stopped. People made films, but you began to see, I think, you know, as you get into the 2000s, practically every year there's a lessening of the film audience. Profits don't go down that much simply because the prices keep getting higher. There are a couple of years that were exceptions. 2009, I think it was, for Avatar, and 2017 for Black Panther, a couple of, you know, years where there was some film that literally everybody wanted to see, and suddenly the numbers go up. Maybe the year of Barbie and Oppenheimer, that might have happened too. But the general trend has been audience attendance just keeps going down. It's gotten very expensive. And I went to see a few weeks ago Gladiator after 6 o'clock screening. There weren't 12 people in the cinema. I mean, wow, isn't this like a big hit? You know, so,
right.
I mean, I didn't think it was much of a film, but beyond that, I thought there'd be, you know, somebody there.
Right.
And I think that, unfortunately, is a trend. Now, I understand Wicked's been doing great, and it's really, you know, filling the theaters and maybe a couple of other things, but, you know, people are not going to the movies as much as they used to, and that's something I'm very concerned about. My own prediction is that within a few years, I don't know how many, but probably, I don't think, more than 10, the exhibition sector will sort of be divided into a kind of what you might think of as virtual reality cinema, which is really where the Marvel movies are going. As someone once said to me, someone who worked in Hollywood and had some knowledge of these things, in the future, when you go to see the Avengers, they won't be fighting in front of you, they'll be fighting next to you. That you'll really be in this immersive environment of these films, which is really what they're calling for in lots of ways. I think you'll have most things that we would consider movies will all be on platforms. Maybe in a couple of cities, they might deign to give the film a sort of theatrical run at the IFC Center or something like that. And then the last is you will have some museum-like places where film is shown in a more traditional way. But these will really be in just a few cities or maybe university towns or things like that. So that will become the new, I'd say, panorama of a film going. Now, I'd like to be wrong, and some people tell me, oh no, young people are really rediscovering the movies. If you go to the movies such and such a place, you'll see so many young people there. And over the summer, I was in Brazil and the Cinemateca Brasileira in São Paulo. I was just amazed that, you know, almost anything you went to was packed and packed with young people. So maybe there's a little hope, but I tend to think these are trends or fads or something like that. And the sort of general arc is moving away from that.
Right, right. Do you think, for example, that in filmmaking itself, there might be also kind of, you know, retro phase in the same way that, you know, we're now sort of rediscovering vinyl records and going back to black and white, for example, cinema? Or no, you don't think that?
I don't think so. If Christopher Nolan wants to, you know, project a film upside down, the studios will let him do it because he's a very powerful guy.
Right.
You know, so if he says, I want to show my film in 70 millimeter, yeah, they'll say yes, you know, and they'll do a little. It'll be like advertisement. you know. Right. But, you know, often those things are money losers, you know, and they just do it to satisfy the whim of whoever the filmmaker is. I know that Paul Thomas Anderson actually paid for a 70-millimeter print of Licorice Pizza to be shown in Paris. And, you know, it was very popular, ran for a long time and things like that. But these are, you know, eccentric examples. I think very few filmmakers can get away with that nowadays. And certainly that's not the trend.
Right, right. And in a way, what's fundamental to cinema and what you've described, the storytelling element, it seems that virtual technology and AI that is being applied actually is not changing the fundamentals storytelling.
Well, I think it is, actually. I think we're going to a much less narratively driven era. I mean, you know, if I don't see that many Marvel movies, but the few that I do seem to have practically eliminated narrative at this point. I mean, the stories are what would you call them? Plot points. They're not really stories in that way. There's very little development. But what exists is spectacle. You know, one can always say there's always been a kind of dichotomy or tension in the cinema between story and spectacle, what you're trying to tell and how you say it in a way. Well, I think the latter has completely taken over. I think that the Marvel movies are about spectacle. And so because of that, they've reduced the story part to the bare essentials. This is a bad guy. This is a good guy. They're fighting. It doesn't really go much beyond that, you know? So I think in that way you could say that, you know, I think cinema really began non-narrative. It had to learn how to tell stories. And eventually it became a narrative medium, fundamentally a narrative medium. I think since the 80s we've been moving away from that. And I think more and more, while there still are films that are storytelling films, I think a lot of the biggest trend I think I find in these Marvel-type movies, and it's not just Marvel, but anything with lots of special effects, is that there's no story. Right. Even Gladiator has no story, really. I mean, it's basically one set piece after another. Okay, when's the rhinoceros coming? Oh, gee, about a few minutes. You know, that's how you feel. Nothing right. there. I mean, whatever dialogue is there is just wasting time until they can get to, or the scene with the sharks or something like mm-hmm. that. So it's really become all spectacle.
And do you feel that storytelling then has been sort of reflected or is reflected more intensely in for example, in series where you have longer?
That's become perhaps, and again, I think that form of cinema exists really on the platforms now. I mean, I think what you're seeing in movies more, in movie theaters more and more, is headed towards spectacle. And perhaps you do, I mean, get that. You know, there the problems become, I think we're still working out the logistics of eight-hour stories. You know, I think that for me, I'm not that much of a series watcher, but one of the problems is that rarely after two episodes do I feel the need to watch the next six. You know, I feel like I've gotten everything out of this that I'm going to get, and I don't really want to go on. Now, obviously, a lot of people disagree and do follow, but I think there are very few series that I've seen that I think are really worth the time, you know. And in fact, I've been told by some of my former students at Columbia that they often will write a screenplay for a film and be told, this is a really great idea, turn it into a series. And again, that makes me sad because ideas for 90 or 100-minute films aren't always right for 8 hours, you know. And if students do it or people do it because obviously they want to work and things like that. But it seems to me a very different format.
Right. Listen, Richard, this has been a really inspiring discussion. Thank you so much.
We've
covered a lot of ground and you've given us a lot to think about. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Emmanuel.
Vis-a-vis is brought to you by the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University, Paris 1 Panthéon Sorbonne, Sciences Po, and École Polytechnique. This podcast is produced by Rachel Kahn and Georgia O'Neill, and I'm Emmanuel Catan. Special thanks to Esther Jackson and her colleagues at Columbia Libraries. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. If you're interested in learning more about the Alliance Program and how we support academic exchanges, research, and collaboration between the US and France, please visit us at alliance.columbia.edu or follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.